I'm not picking that up. The taxi slammed against the guardrail and skidded along with a horrible grinding noise. The whole car shuddered, billowing gray smoke as if it were about to dissolve from the strain.
Going to be sick, Tyson warned.
Annabeth, I yelled, let Tyson use your backpack. Are you crazy? Get the eye! Wasp yanked the wheel, and the taxi swerved away from the rail. We hurtled down the bridge toward Brooklyn, going faster than any human taxi. The Gray sisters screeched and pummeled each other and cried out for their eye. At last, I steeled my nerves. I ripped off a chunk of my tie-dye T-shirt, which was already falling apart from all the burn marks, and used it to pick the eyeball off the floor.
Nice boy!
Anger cried, as if she somehow knew I had her missing peeper.
Give it back!
Not until you explain, I told her. What were you talking about? The location I seek?
No time, Tempest cried. Accelerating!
I looked out the window. Sure enough, trees and cars and whole neighborhoods were now zipping by in a gray blur. We were already out of Brooklyn, heading through the middle of Long Island. Percy, Annabeth warned, they can't find our destination without the eye. We'll just keep accelerating until we break into a million pieces. First they have to tell me, I said, or I'll open the window and throw the eye into oncoming traffic.
No!
The Gray sisters wailed.
Too dangerous.
I'm rolling down the window.
Wait!
The Gray sisters screamed.
30, 31, 75, 12.
They belted it out like a quarterback calling a play. What do you mean? I said. That makes no sense.
30, 31, 75, 12.
Anger wailed.
That's all we can tell you. Now give us the eye. Almost to camp.
We were off the highway now, zipping through the countryside of northern Long Island. I could see Half-Blood Hill ahead of us, with its giant pine tree at the crest, Thalia's tree, which contained the life force of a fallen hero. Percy, Annabeth said more urgently, give them the eye now! I decided not to argue. I threw the eye into Wasp's lap. The old lady snatched it up, pushed it into her eye socket like somebody putting in a contact lens, and blinked.
Whoa!
She slammed on the brakes. The taxi spun four or five times in a cloud of smoke and squealed to a halt in the middle of the farm road at the base of Half-Blood Hill. Tyson let loose a huge belch.
Better now.
All right, I told the Gray sisters. Now tell me what those numbers mean. No time. Annabeth opened her door. We have to get out now. I was about to ask why, when I looked up at Half-Blood Hill and understood. At the crest of the hill was a group of campers, and they were under attack. Chapter 4. Tyson plays with fire. Mythologically speaking, if there's anything I hate worse than trios of old ladies, it's bulls. Last summer, I fought the Minotaur on top of Half-Blood Hill. This time, what I saw up there was even worse. Two bulls, and not just regular bulls, bronze ones the size of elephants. And even that wasn't bad enough. Naturally, they had to breathe fire, too. As soon as we exited the taxi, the Gray sisters peeled out, heading back to New York, where life was safer. They didn't even wait for their extra 3 drachma payment. They just left us on the side of the road, Annabeth with nothing but her backpack and knife, Tyson and me still in our burnt-up tie-dye gym clothes.
"Oh, man,"
said Annabeth, looking at the battle raging on the hill. What worried me most weren't the bulls themselves, or the 10 heroes in full battle armor who were getting their bronze-plated booties whooped. What worried me was that the bulls were ranging all over the hill, even around the backside of the pine tree. That shouldn't have been possible. The camp's magic boundaries didn't allow monsters to cross past Thalia's tree. But the metal bulls were doing it anyway. One of the heroes shouted, "Border Patrol! To me!" A girl's voice, gruff and familiar. Border Patrol? I thought. The camp didn't have a Border Patrol. "It's Clarice," Annabeth said. "Come on, we have to help her." Normally, rushing to Clarice's aid would not have been high on my to-do list. She was one of the biggest bullies at camp. The first time we'd met, she tried to introduce my head to a toilet. She was also a daughter of Ares, and I'd had a very serious disagreement with her father last summer, so now the god of war and all his children basically hated my guts. Still, she was in trouble. Her fellow warriors were scattering, running in panic as the bulls charged. The grass was burning in huge swaths around the pine tree. One hero screamed and waved his arms as he ran in circles, the horsehair plume on his helmet blazing like a fiery mohawk. Clarice's own armor was charred. She was fighting with a broken spear shaft, the other end embedded uselessly in the metal joint of one bull's shoulder. I uncapped my ballpoint pen. It shimmered, growing longer and heavier until I held the bronze sword Anaclismus in my hands. "Tyson, stay here. I don't want you taking any more chances." "No," Annabeth said. "We need him." I stared at her. "He's mortal. He got lucky with the dodgeballs, but he can't..." "Percy, do you know what those are up there?" "The Colchis bulls, made by Hephaestus himself. We can't fight them without Medea's sunscreen SPF 50,000. We'll get burned to a crisp." "Medea's what?" Annabeth rummaged through her backpack and cursed. "I had a jar of tropical coconut scent sitting on my nightstand at home. Why didn't I bring it?" I'd learned a long time ago not to question Annabeth too much. It just made me more confused. "Look, I don't know what you're talking about, but I'm not going to let Tyson get fried."
"Percy!"
"Tyson, stay back." I raised my sword. "I'm going in." Tyson tried to protest, but I was already running up the hill toward Clarice, who was yelling at her patrol, trying to get them into phalanx formation. It was a good idea. The few who were listening lined up shoulder to shoulder, locking their shields to form an oxhide and bronze wall, their spears bristling over the top like porcupine quills. Unfortunately, Clarice could only muster 6 campers. The other 4 were still running around with their helmets on fire. Annabeth ran toward them, trying to help. She taunted one of the bulls into chasing her, then turned invisible, completely confusing the monster. The other bull charged Clarice's line. I was halfway up the hill, not close enough to help. Clarice hadn't even seen me yet. The bull moved deadly fast for something so big. Its metal hide gleamed in the sun. It had fist-sized rubies for eyes and horns of polished silver. When it opened its hinged mouth, a column of white-hot flame blasted out. "Hold the line!" Clarice ordered her warriors. Whatever else you could say about Clarice, she was brave. She was a big girl with cruel eyes like her father's. She looked like she was born to wear Greek battle armor, but I didn't see how even she could stand against that bull's charge. Unfortunately, at that moment, the other bull lost interest in finding Annabeth. It turned, wheeling around behind Clarice on her unprotected side. "Behind you!" I yelled. "Look out!" I shouldn't have said anything because all I did was startle her. Bull number 1 crashed into her shield, and the phalanx broke. Clarice went flying backward and landed in a smoldering patch of grass. The bull charged past her, but not before blasting the other heroes with its fiery breath. Their shields melted right off their arms. They dropped their weapons and ran as bull number 2 closed in on Clarice for the kill. I lunged forward and grabbed Clarice by the straps of her armor. I dragged her out of the way just as bull number 2 freight trained past. I gave it a good swipe with Riptide and cut a huge gash in its flank. But the monster just creaked and groaned and kept on going. It hadn't touched me, but I could feel the heat of its metal skin. Its body temperature could have microwaved a frozen burrito.
Let me go!
Clarice pummeled my hand.
Percy, curse you!
I dropped her in a heap next to the pine tree and turned to face the bulls. We were on the inside slope of the hill now, the valley of Camp Half-Blood directly below us, the cabins, the training facilities, the big house, all of it at risk if these bulls got past us. Annabeth shouted orders to the other heroes, telling them to spread out and keep the bulls distracted. Bull number one ran a wide arc, making its way back toward me. As it passed the middle of the hill, where the invisible boundary line should have kept it out, it slowed down a little, as if it were struggling against a strong wind. But then it broke through and kept coming. Bull number two turned to face me, fire sputtering from the gash I'd cut in its side. I couldn't tell if it felt any pain, but its ruby eyes seemed to glare at me like I'd just made things personal. I couldn't fight both bulls at the same time. I'd have to take down bull number two first, cut its head off before bull number one charged back into range. My arms already felt tired. I realized how long it had been since I'd worked out with Riptide, how out of practice I was. I lunged, but bull number two blew flames at me. I rolled aside as the air turned to pure heat. All the oxygen was sucked out of my lungs. My foot caught on something, a tree root maybe, and pain shot up my ankle. Still, I managed to slash with my sword and lop off part of the monster's snout. It galloped away wild and disoriented. But before I could feel too good about that, I tried to stand, and my left leg buckled underneath me. My ankle was sprained, maybe broken. Bull number one charged straight toward me. No way could I crawl out of its path. Annabeth shouted,
"Tyson, help him!"
Somewhere near, toward the crest of the hill, Tyson wailed,
"Can't get through!"
"I, Annabeth Chase, give you permission to enter camp."
Thunder shook the hillside. Suddenly, Tyson was there, barreling toward me, yelling,
"Percy needs help!"
Before I could tell him no, he dove between me and the bull just as it unleashed a nuclear firestorm.
"Tyson!"
I yelled. The blast swirled around him like a red tornado. I could only see the black silhouette of his body. I knew with horrible certainty that my friend had just been turned into a column of ashes. But when the fire died, Tyson was still standing there, completely unharmed. Not even his grungy clothes were scorched. The bull must have been as surprised as I was, because before it could unleash a second blast, Tyson balled his fists and slammed them into the bull's face.
"Bad cow!"
His fists made a crater where the bronze bull's snout used to be. Two small columns of flame shot out of its ears. Tyson hit it again, and the bronze crumpled under his hands like aluminum foil. The bull's face now looked like a sock puppet pulled inside out.
"Down!"
Tyson yelled. The bull staggered and fell on its back. Its legs moved feebly in the air, steam coming out of its ruined head in odd places. Annabeth ran over to check on me. My ankle felt like it was filled with acid, but she gave me some Olympian nectar to drink from her canteen, and I immediately started to feel better. There was a burning smell that I later learned was me. The hair on my arms had been completely singed off.
"The other bull?"
I asked. Annabeth pointed down the hill. Clarice had taken care of bad cow number two. She'd impaled it through the back leg with a celestial bronze spear. Now, with its snout half gone and a huge gash in its side, it was trying to run in slow motion, going in circles like some kind of merry-go-round animal. Clarice pulled off her helmet and marched toward us. A strand of her stringy brown hair was smoldering, but she didn't seem to notice.
"You ruin everything,"
she yelled at me.
"I had it under control."
I was too stunned to answer. Annabeth grumbled.
"Good to see you too, Clarice."
"Arr!" Clarice screamed. "Don't ever, ever try saving me again."
"Clarice,"
Annabeth said, "you've got wounded campers." That sobered her up. Even Clarice cared about the soldiers under her command.
"I'll be back,"
she growled, then trudged off to assess the damage. I stared at Tyson.
"You didn't die."
Tyson looked down like he was embarrassed.
"I am sorry. Came to help. Disobeyed you."
"My fault," Annabeth said. "I had no choice. I had to let Tyson cross the boundary line to save you. Otherwise, you would have died."
"Let him cross the boundary line?" I asked. "But..."
"Percy," she said, "have you ever looked at Tyson closely? I mean, in the face? Ignore the mist and really look at him." The mist makes humans see only what their brains can process. I knew it could fool demigods too, but... I looked Tyson in the face. It wasn't easy. I'd always had trouble looking directly at him, though I'd never quite understood why. I thought it was just because he always had peanut butter in his crooked teeth. I forced myself to focus at his big lumpy nose, then a little higher at his eyes. No, not eyes. One eye. One large, calf-brown eye, right in the middle of his forehead, with thick lashes and big tears trickling down his cheeks on either side.
"Tyson," I stammered.
"You're a cyclops," Annabeth offered. "A baby, by the looks of him. Probably why he couldn't get past the boundary line as easily as the bulls. Tyson's one of the homeless orphans."
"One of the what?"
"They're in almost all the big cities," Annabeth said distastefully.
"They're mistakes, Percy. Children of nature spirits and gods. Well, one god in particular, usually, and they don't always come out right. No one wants them. They get tossed aside. They grow up wild on the streets. I don't know how this one found you, but he obviously likes you. We should take him to Chiron, let him decide what to do."
"But the fire, how..."
"He's a cyclops."
Annabeth paused, as if she were remembering something unpleasant. "They work the forges of the gods. They have to be immune to fire. That's what I was trying to tell you." I was completely shocked. How had I never realized what Tyson was? But I didn't have much time to think about it just then. The whole side of the hill was burning. Wounded heroes needed attention, and there were still two banged-up bronze bulls to dispose of, which I didn't figure would fit in our normal recycling bins. Clarice came back over and wiped the soot off her forehead.
"Jackson, if you can stand, get up. We need to carry the wounded back to the big house. Let Tantalus know what's happened."
"Tantalus?" I asked.
"The activities director,"
Clarice said impatiently. "Chiron is the activities director. And where's Argus? He's head of security. He should be here." Clarice made a sour face.
"Argus got fired. You two have been gone too long. Things are changing."
"But Chiron, he's trained kids to fight monsters for over 3,000 years. He can't just be gone. What happened?"
"That happened," Clarice snapped.
She pointed to Thalia's tree. Every camper knew the story behind the tree. 6 years ago, Grover, Annabeth, and two other demigods named Thalia and Luke had come to Camp Half-Blood chased by an army of monsters. When they got cornered on top of this hill, Thalia, a daughter of Zeus, had made her last stand here to give her friends time to reach safety.
As she was dying, her father, Zeus, took pity on her and changed her into a pine tree. Her spirit had reinforced the magic borders of the camp, protecting it from monsters. The pine had been here ever since, strong and healthy. But now, its needles were yellow. A huge pile of dead ones littered the base of the tree. In the center of the trunk, 3 feet from the ground, was a puncture mark the size of a bullet hole, oozing green sap. A sliver of ice ran through my chest. Now I understood why the camp was in danger. The magical borders were failing because Thalia's tree was dying. Someone had poisoned it.
Chapter 5. I get a new cabin mate. Ever come home and found your room messed up? Like some helpful person, hi mom, has tried to clean it, and suddenly you can't find anything? And even if nothing is missing, you get that creepy feeling like somebody's been looking through your private stuff and dusting everything with lemon furniture polish? That's kind of the way I felt seeing Camp Half-Blood again. On the surface, things didn't look all that different. The big house was still there with its blue gabled roof and its wraparound porch. The strawberry field still baked in the sun. The same white-columned Greek buildings were scattered around the valley. The amphitheater, the combat arena, the dining pavilion overlooking Long Island Sound. And nestled between the woods and the creek were the same cabins. A crazy assortment of 12 buildings, each representing a different Olympian god. But there was an air of danger now. You could tell something was wrong. Instead of playing volleyball in the sandpit, counselors and satyrs were stockpiling weapons in the tool shed. Dryads armed with bows and arrows talked nervously at the edge of the woods. The forest looked sickly. The grass in the meadow was pale yellow, and the fire marks on Half-Blood Hill stood out like ugly scars. Somebody had messed with my favorite place in the world, and I was not, well, a happy camper. As we made our way to the big house, I recognized a lot of kids from last summer. Nobody stopped to talk. Nobody said, "Welcome back." Some did double takes when they saw Tyson, but most just walked grimly past and carried on with their duties, running messages, toting swords to sharpen on the grinding wheels. The camp felt like a military school, and believe me, I know. I've been kicked out of a couple. None of that mattered to Tyson. He was absolutely fascinated by everything he saw.
"What's that?"
he gasped. "The stables for Pegasi," I said. "The winged horses."
"What's that?"
"Those are the toilets."
"What's that?"
"The cabins for the campers. If they don't know who your Olympian parent is, they put you in the Hermes cabin. That brown one over there. Until you're determined. Then once they know, they put you in your dad or mom's group." He looked at me in awe.
"You have a cabin?"
"Number 3. I pointed to a low gray building made of sea stone.
"You live with friends in the cabin?"
No, just me." I didn't feel like explaining. The embarrassing truth? I was the only one who stayed in that cabin because I wasn't supposed to be alive. The big 3 gods, Zeus, Poseidon, and Hades, had made a pact after World War II not to have any more children with mortals. We were more powerful than regular half-bloods. We were too unpredictable. When we got mad, we tended to cause problems. Like World War II, for instance. The Big 3 pact had only been broken twice. Once when Zeus sired Thalia, once when Poseidon sired me. Neither of us should have been born. Thalia had gotten herself turned into a pine tree when she was 12. Me? Well, I was doing my best not to follow her example. I had nightmares about what Poseidon might turn me into if I were ever on the verge of death. Plankton, maybe, or a floating patch of kelp.
When we got to the big house, we found Chiron in his apartment, listening to his favorite 1960s lounge music while he packed his saddlebags. I guess I should mention, Chiron is a centaur. From the waist up, he looks like a regular middle-aged guy with curly brown hair and a scraggly beard. From the waist down, he's a white stallion. He can pass for human by compacting his lower half into a magic wheelchair. In fact, he'd passed himself off as my Latin teacher during my sixth grade year. But most of the time, if the ceilings are high enough, he prefers hanging out in full centaur form. As soon as we saw him, Tyson froze.
"Pony!"
he cried in total rapture. Chiron turned, looking offended.
"I beg your pardon?"
Annabeth ran up and hugged him. "Chiron, what's happening? You're not leaving?" Her voice was shaky. Chiron was like a second father to her. Chiron ruffled her hair and gave her a kindly smile.
"Hello, child. And Percy, my goodness, you've grown over the year."
I swallowed. "Clarice said you were...
"Fired."
Chiron's eyes glinted with dark humor.
Well, someone had to take the blame. Lord Zeus was most upset. The tree he'd created from the spirit of his daughter poisoned. Mr. D had to punish someone.
"Besides himself, you mean?" I growled. Just the thought of the camp director, Mr. D, made me angry. "But this is crazy," Annabeth cried. "Chiron, you couldn't have had anything to do with poisoning Thalia's tree."
"Nevertheless," Chiron sighed, "some in Olympus do not trust me now, under the circumstances."
"Oh, what circumstances?" I asked. Chiron's face darkened. He stuffed a Latin English dictionary into his saddlebag while the Frank Sinatra music oozed from his boombox. Tyson was still staring at Chiron in amazement. He whimpered like he wanted to pat Chiron's flank, but was afraid to come closer.
"Pony?"
Chiron sniffed.
"My dear young Cyclops, I am a centaur."
"Chiron," I said, "what about the tree? What happened?" He shook his head sadly.
"The poison used on Thalia's pine is something from the underworld, Percy. Some venom even I have never seen. It must have come from a monster quite deep in the pits of Tartarus."
"Then we know who's responsible,
"Do not invoke the Titan Lord's name, Percy. Especially not here, not now."
"But last summer he tried to cause a civil war in Olympus. This has to be his idea. He'd get Luke to do it, that traitor."
"Perhaps," Chiron said. "But I fear I'm being held responsible because I did not prevent it, and I cannot cure it. The tree has only a few weeks of life left unless..."
"Unless what?" Annabeth asked.
"No," Chiron said. "A foolish thought. The whole valley is feeling the shock of the poison. The magical borders are deteriorating. The camp itself is dying. Only one source of magic would be strong enough to reverse the poison, and it was lost centuries ago."
"What is it?" I asked. "We'll go find it." Chiron closed his saddlebag. He pressed the stop button on his boombox. Then he turned and rested his hand on my shoulder, looking me straight in the eyes.
"Percy, you must promise me that you will not act rashly. I told your mother I did not want you to come here at all this summer. It's much too dangerous. But now that you are here, stay here. Train hard. Learn to fight. But do not leave."
"Why?" I asked. "I want to do something. I can't just let the borders fail. The whole camp will be..."
"Overrun by monsters," Chiron said. "Yes, I fear so. But you must not let yourself be baited into hasty action. This could be a trap of the Titan Lord. Remember last summer, he almost took your life."
It was true, but still, I wanted to help so badly. I also wanted to make Kronos pay. I mean, you'd think the Titan Lord would have learned his lesson eons ago when he was overthrown by the gods.
You'd think getting chopped into a million pieces and cast into the darkest part of the underworld would give him a subtle clue that nobody wanted him around. But no, because he was immortal, he was still alive down there in Tartarus, suffering an eternal pain, hungering to return and take revenge on Olympus. He couldn't act on his own, but he was great at twisting the minds of mortals and even gods to do his dirty work. The poisoning had to be his doing. Who else would be so low as to attack Thalia's tree, the only thing left of a hero who'd given her life to save her friends? Annabeth was trying hard not to cry. Chiron brushed a tear from her cheek.
"Stay with Percy, child," he told her. "Keep him safe. The prophecy. Remember it."
I will. I said, "would this be the super dangerous prophecy that has me in it, but the gods have forbidden you to tell me about?" Nobody answered. "Right," I muttered. "Just checking." "Chiron," Annabeth said, "you told me the gods made you immortal only so long as you were needed to train heroes. If they dismiss you from camp..."
"Swear you will do your best to keep Percy from danger," he insisted. "Swear upon the river Styx."
I swear it upon the river Styx," Annabeth said. Thunder rumbled outside.
"Very well," Chiron said.
He seemed to relax just a little.
"Perhaps my name will be cleared and I shall return. Until then, I go to visit my wild kinsmen in the Everglades. It's possible they know of some cure for the poison tree that I have forgotten. In any event, I will stay in exile until this matter is resolved, one way or another."
Annabeth stifled a sob. Chiron patted her shoulder awkwardly.
"There now, child. I must entrust your safety to Mr. D and the new activities director. We must hope, well, perhaps they won't destroy the camp quite as quickly as I fear."
"Who is this Tantalus guy anyway?" I demanded. "Where does he get off taking your job?" A Concorn blew across the valley. I hadn't realized how late it was. It was time for the campers to assemble for dinner.
"Go," Chiron said. "You will meet him at the pavilion. I will contact your mother, Percy, and let her know you're safe. No doubt she'll be worried by now. Just remember my warning. You are in grave danger. Do not think for a moment that the Titan Lord has forgotten you."
With that, he clopped out of the apartment and down the hall, Tyson calling after him.
"Pony, don't go."
I realized I'd forgotten to tell Chiron about my dream of Grover. Now it was too late. The best teacher I'd ever had was gone. Maybe for good. Tyson started bawling almost as bad as Annabeth. I tried to tell them that things would be okay, but I didn't believe it. The sun was setting behind the dining pavilion as the campers came up from their cabins. We stood in the shadow of a marble column and watched them file in. Annabeth was still pretty shaken up, but she'd promised she'd talk to us later. Then she went off to join her siblings from the Athena cabin, a dozen boys and girls with blonde hair and gray eyes like hers. Annabeth wasn't the oldest, but she'd been at camp more summers than just about anybody. You could tell that by looking at her camp necklace. One bead for every summer, and Annabeth had six. No one questioned her right to lead the line. Next came Clarice, leading the Ares cabin. She had one arm in a sling and a nasty-looking gash on her cheek, but otherwise, her encounter with the bronze bulls didn't seem to have fazed her. Someone had taped a piece of paper to her back that said, "You moo, girl." But nobody in her cabin was bothering to tell her about it. After the Ares kids came the Hephaestus cabin, six guys led by Charles Beckendorf, a big 15-year-old African-American kid. He had hands the size of catcher's mitts and a face that was hard and squinty from looking into a blacksmith's forge all day. He was nice enough once you got to know him, but no one ever called him Charlie or Chuck or Charles. Most just called him Beckendorf. Rumor was he could make anything. Give him a chunk of metal, and he could create a razor-sharp sword or a robotic warrior or a singing birdbath for your grandmother's garden. Whatever you wanted. The other cabins filed in. Demeter, Apollo, Aphrodite, Dionysus. Naiads came up from the canoe lake. Dryads melted out of the trees. From the meadow came a dozen satyrs, who reminded me painfully of Grover. I'd always had a soft spot for the satyrs. When they were at camp, they had to do all kinds of odd jobs for Mr. D, the director, but their most important work was out in the real world. They were the camp seekers. They went undercover into schools all over the world looking for potential half-bloods and escorting them back to camp. That's how I'd met Grover. He had been the first one to recognize I was a demigod. After the satyrs filed into dinner, the Hermes cabin brought up the rear. They were always the biggest cabin. Last summer, it had been led by Luke, the guy who'd fought with Thalia and Annabeth on top of Half-Blood Hill. For a while, before Poseidon had claimed me, I'd lodged in the Hermes cabin. Luke had befriended me, and then he tried to kill me. Now the Hermes cabin was led by Travis and Connor Stoll. They weren't twins, but they looked so much alike it didn't matter. I could never remember which one was older. They were both tall and skinny, with mops of brown hair that hung in their eyes. They wore orange camp half-blood t-shirts untucked over baggy shorts, and they had those elfish features all Hermes kids had. Upturned eyebrows, sarcastic smiles, a gleam in their eyes whenever they looked at you, like they were about to drop a firecracker down your shirt. I'd always thought it was funny that the god of thieves would have kids with the last name Stoll, but the only time I mentioned it to Travis and Connor, they both stared at me blankly like they didn't get the joke. As soon as the last campers had filed in, I led Tyson into the middle of the pavilion. Conversations faltered, heads turned. "Who invited that?" somebody at the Apollo table murmured. I glared in their direction, but I couldn't figure out who'd spoken. From the head table, a familiar voice drawled, "Well, well, if it isn't Peter Johnson, my millennium is complete." I gritted my teeth. "Percy Jackson, sir." Mr. D sipped his Diet Coke. "Yes, well, as you young people say these days, whatever." He was wearing his usual leopard-pattern Hawaiian shirt, walking shorts, and tennis shoes with black socks. With his pudgy belly and his blotchy red face, he looked like a Las Vegas tourist who'd stayed up too late in the casinos. Behind him, a nervous-looking satyr was peeling the skins off grapes and handing them to Mr. D one at a time. Mr. D's real name is Dionysus, the god of wine. Zeus appointed him director of Camp Half-Blood to dry out for 100 years, a punishment for chasing some off-limits wood nymph. Next to him, where Chiron usually sat, or stood in centaur form, was someone I'd never seen before. A pale, horribly thin man in a threadbare orange prisoner's jumpsuit. The number over his pocket read 0001. He had blue shadows under his eyes, dirty fingernails, and badly cut gray hair, like his last haircut had been done with a weed whacker. He stared at me. His eyes made me nervous. He looked fractured, angry and frustrated and hungry all at the same time. "This boy," Dionysus told him, "you need to watch. Poseidon's child, you know." "Ah," the prisoner said, "that one." His tone made it obvious that he and Dionysus had already discussed me at length. "I am Tantalus," the prisoner said, smiling coldly. "On special assignment here until, well, until my lord Dionysus decides otherwise. And you, Perseus Jackson, I do expect you to refrain from causing any more trouble.
Trouble? I demanded. Dionysus snapped his fingers. A newspaper appeared on the table, the front page of today's New York Post. There was my yearbook picture for Meriwether Prep. It was hard for me to make out the headline, but I had a pretty good guess what it said. Something like, 13-year-old lunatic torches gymnasium.
Yes, trouble, Tantalus said with satisfaction. You caused plenty of it last summer, I understand.
I was too mad to speak, like it was my fault the gods had almost gotten into a civil war. A satyr inched forward nervously and set a plate of barbecue in front of Tantalus. The new activities director licked his lips. He looked at his empty goblet and said,
Root beer, Bark special stock, 1967.
The glass filled itself with foamy soda. Tantalus stretched out his hand hesitantly, as if he were afraid the goblet was hot.
Go on then, old fellow,
Dionysus said, a strange sparkle in his eyes.
Perhaps now it will work.
Tantalus grabbed for the glass, but it scooted away before he could touch it. A few drops of root beer spilled, and Tantalus tried to dab them up with his fingers, but the drops rolled away like quicksilver before he could touch them. He growled and turned toward the plate of barbecue. He picked up a fork and tried to stab a piece of brisket, but the plate skittered down the table and flew off the end, straight into the coals of the brazier.
Blast! Tantalus muttered.
Ah, well,
Dionysus said, his voice dripping with false sympathy.
Perhaps a few more days. Believe me, old chap, working at this camp will be torture enough. I'm sure your old curse will fade eventually.
Eventually,
muttered Tantalus, staring at Dionysus's Diet Coke.
Do you have any idea how dry one's throat gets after 3,000 years?
You're that spirit from the fields of punishment, I said. The one who stands in the lake with the fruit tree hanging over you, but you can't eat or drink.
Tantalus sneered at me. A real scholar, aren't you, boy?
You must have done something really horrible when you were alive, I said, mildly impressed. What was it? Tantalus's eyes narrowed. Behind him, the satyrs were shaking their heads vigorously, trying to warn me.
I'll be watching you, Percy Jackson, Tantalus said. I don't want any problems at my camp.
Your camp has problems already, sir.
Oh, go sit down, Johnson, Dionysus sighed. I believe that table over there is yours, the one where no one else ever wants to sit.
My face was burning, but I knew better than to talk back. Dionysus was an overgrown brat, but he was an immortal, super powerful overgrown brat. I said, Come on, Tyson.
Oh, no, Tantalus said. The monster stays here. We must decide what to do with it.
Him, I snapped. His name is Tyson. The new activities director raised an eyebrow. Tyson saved the camp, I insisted. He pounded those bronze bulls, otherwise it would have burned down this whole place.
Yes, Tantalus sighed. And what a pity that would have been.
Dionysus snickered.
Leave us, Tantalus ordered. While we decide this creature's fate.
Tyson looked at me with fear in his one big eye, but I knew I couldn't disobey a direct order from the camp directors. Not openly, anyway.
I'll be right over here, big guy, I promised. Don't worry, we'll find you a good place to sleep tonight.
Tyson nodded.
I believe you. You are my friend.
Which made me feel a whole lot guiltier. I trudged over to the Poseidon table and slumped onto the bench. A wood nymph brought me a plate of Olympian olive and pepperoni pizza, but I wasn't hungry. I'd been almost killed twice today. I'd managed to end my school year with a complete disaster. Camp Half-Blood was in serious trouble, and Chiron had told me not to do anything about it.
I didn't feel very thankful, but I took my dinner, as was customary, up to the bronze brazier and scraped part of it into the flames. "Poseidon," I murmured, "accept my offering. And send me some help while you're at it," I prayed silently. "Please." The smoke from the burning pizza changed into something fragrant, the smell of a clean sea breeze with wildflowers mixed in. But I had no idea if that meant my father was really listening. I went back to my seat. I didn't think things could get much worse. But then Tantalus had one of the satyrs blow the conch horn to get her attention for announcements.
"Yes, well," Tantalus said,
once the talking had died down,
"another fine meal, or so I am told."
As he spoke, he inched his hand toward his refilled dinner plate, as if maybe the food wouldn't notice what he was doing, but it did. It shot away down the table as soon as he got within 6 inches.
"And here on my first day of authority," he continued, "I'd like to say what a pleasant form of punishment it is to be here. Over the course of the summer, I hope to interact with each and every one of you children. You all look good enough to eat."
Dionysus clapped politely, leading to some half-hearted applause from the satyrs. Tyson was still standing at the head table, looking uncomfortable, but every time he tried to scoot out of the limelight, Tantalus pulled him back.
"And now some changes."
Tantalus gave the campers a crooked smile.
"We are reinstituting the chariot races."
Murmuring broke out at all the tables. Excitement, fear, disbelief.
"Now I know,"
Tantalus continued, raising his voice,
"that these races were discontinued some years ago due to, technical problems."
"Three deaths and 26 mutilations,"
someone at the Apollo table called.
"Yes, yes," Tantalus said. "But I know that you will all join me in welcoming the return of this camp tradition. Golden laurels will go to the winning charioteers each month. Teams may register in the morning. The first race will be held in 3 days' time. We will release you from most of your regular activities to prepare your chariots and choose your horses. Oh, and did I mention, the victorious team's cabin will have no chores for the month in which they win?"
An explosion of excited conversation. No KP for a whole month? No stable cleaning? Was he serious? Then the last person I expected to object did so.
"But sir,"
Clarice said. She looked nervous, but she stood up to speak from the Ares table. Some of the campers snickered when they saw the "You Moo Girl" sign on her back.
"What about patrol duty? I mean, if we drop everything to ready our chariots."
"Ah, the hero of the day,"
Tantalus exclaimed.
"Brave Clarice, who single-handedly bested the bronze bulls."
Clarice blinked, then blushed.
"I didn't."
"And modest, too," Tantalus grinned. "Not to worry, my dear. This is a summer camp. We are here to enjoy ourselves, yes?"
"But the tree..."
"And now,"
Tantalus said, as several of Clarice's cabin mates pulled her back into her seat.
"Before we proceed to the campfire and sing-along, one slight housekeeping issue. Percy Jackson and Annabeth Chase have seen fit, for some reason, to bring this here."
Tantalus waved a hand toward Tyson. Uneasy murmuring spread among the campers. A lot of sideways looks at me. I wanted to kill Tantalus.
"Now, of course," he said, "Cyclopes have a reputation for being bloodthirsty monsters with a very small brain capacity. Under normal circumstances, I would release this beast into the woods and have you hunt it down with torches and pointed sticks. But who knows? Perhaps this Cyclops is not as horrible as most of its brethren. Until it proves worthy of destruction, we need a place to keep it. I've thought about the stables, but that will make the horses nervous. Hermes cabin, possibly?
Silence at the Hermes table. Travis and Connor Stoll developed a sudden interest in the tablecloth. I couldn't blame them. The Hermes cabin was always full to bursting. There was no way they could take in a 6'3" cyclops.
Come now, Tantalus chided. The monster may be able to do some menial chores. Any suggestions as to where such a beast should be kenneled?
Suddenly everybody gasped. Tantalus scooted away from Tyson in surprise. All I could do was stare in disbelief at the brilliant green light that was about to change my life. A dazzling holographic image that had appeared above Tyson's head. With a sickening twist in my stomach, I remembered what Annabeth had said about Cyclopes. They're the children of nature, spirits, and gods. Well, one god in particular, usually. Swirling over Tyson was a glowing green trident, the same symbol that had appeared above me the day Poseidon had claimed me as his son. There was a moment of awed silence. Being claimed was a rare event. Some campers waited in vain for it their whole lives. When I'd been claimed by Poseidon last summer, everyone had reverently knelt. But now, they followed Tantalus's lead, and Tantalus roared with laughter.
Well, I think we know where to put the beast now. By the gods, I can see the family resemblance.
Everybody laughed except Annabeth and a few of my other friends. Tyson didn't seem to notice. He was too mystified, trying to swat the glowing trident that was now fading over his head. He was too innocent to understand how much they were making fun of him, how cruel people were. But I got it. I had a new cabin mate. I had a monster for a half-brother. Chapter 6 Demon Pigeons Attack. The next few days were torture, just like Tantalus wanted. First there was Tyson moving into the Poseidon cabin, giggling to himself every 15 seconds and saying,
"Percy is my brother?"
Like he'd just won the lottery. Tyson, I'd say, "it's not that simple." But there was no explaining it to him. He was in heaven. And me, as much as I liked the big guy, I couldn't help feeling embarrassed, ashamed. There, I said it. My father, the all-powerful Poseidon, had gotten moony-eyed for some nature spirit, and Tyson had been the result. I mean, I'd read the myths about Cyclopes. I even remembered that they were often Poseidon's children. But I'd never really processed that this made them my family. Until I had Tyson living with me in the next bunk. And then there were the comments from the other campers. Suddenly, I wasn't Percy Jackson, the cool guy who'd retrieved Zeus's lightning bolt last summer. Now, I was Percy Jackson, the poor schmuck with the ugly monster for a brother. "He's not my real brother," I protested whenever Tyson wasn't around. "He's more like a half-brother, on the monstrous side of the family, like a half-brother twice removed or something." Nobody bought it. I admit, I was angry at my dad. I felt like being his son was now a joke. Annabeth tried to make me feel better. She suggested we team up for the chariot race to take our minds off our problems. Don't get me wrong, we both hated Tantalus, and we were worried sick about camp, but we didn't know what to do about it. Until we could come up with some brilliant plan to save Thalia's tree, we figured we might as well go along with the races. After all, Annabeth's mom, Athena, had invented the chariot, and my dad had created horses. Together, we would own that track. One morning, Annabeth and I were sitting by the canoe lake sketching chariot designs when some jokers from Aphrodite's cabin walked by and asked me if I needed to borrow some eyeliner for my eye.
Oh, sorry. Eyes.
As they walked away laughing, Annabeth grumbled, "Just ignore them, Percy. It isn't your fault you have a monster for a brother." "He's not my brother," I snapped. "And he's not a monster either." Annabeth raised her eyebrows. "Hey, don't get mad at me. And technically, he is a monster." "Well, you gave him permission to enter the camp." "Because it was the only way to save your life. I mean, I'm sorry, Percy. I didn't expect Poseidon to claim him. Cyclopes are the most deceitful, treacherous..." "He is not. What have you got against Cyclopes anyway?" Annabeth's ears turned pink. I got the feeling there was something she wasn't telling me, something bad. "Just forget it," she said. "Now, the axle for this chariot, you're treating him like he's this horrible thing," I said. "He saved my life." Annabeth threw down her pencil and stood.
"Then maybe you should design a chariot with him."
"Maybe I should."
"Fine.
Fine." She stormed off and left me feeling even worse than before. The next couple of days, I tried to keep my mind off my problems. Selena Beauregard, one of the nicer girls from Aphrodite's cabin, gave me my first riding lesson on a Pegasus. She explained that there was only one immortal winged horse named Pegasus, who still wandered free somewhere in the skies, but over the eons, he'd sired a lot of children, none quite so fast or heroic, but all named after the first and greatest. Being the son of the sea god, I never liked going into the air. My dad had this rivalry with Zeus, so I tried to stay out of the Lord of the Skies domain as much as possible. But riding a winged horse felt different. It didn't make me nearly as nervous as being in an airplane. Maybe that was because my dad had created horses out of seafoam, so the Pegasi were sort of neutral territory. I could understand their thoughts. I wasn't surprised when my Pegasus went galloping over the treetops or chased a flock of seagulls into a cloud. The problem was that Tyson wanted to ride the chicken ponies, too, but the Pegasi got skittish whenever he approached. I told them telepathically that Tyson wouldn't hurt them, but they didn't seem to believe me. That made Tyson cry. The only person at camp who had no problem with Tyson was Beckendorf from the Hephaestus cabin. The blacksmith god had always worked with Cyclopes in his forges, so Beckendorf took Tyson down to the armory to teach him metalworking. He said he'd have Tyson crafting magic items like a master in no time. After lunch, I worked out in the arena with Apollo's cabin. Swordplay had always been my strength. People said I was better at it than any camper in the last 100 years, except maybe Luke. People always compared me to Luke. I thrashed the Apollo guys easily. I should have been testing myself against the Ares and Athena cabins, since they had the best sword fighters, but I didn't get along with Clarice and her siblings, and after my argument with Annabeth, I just didn't want to see her. I went to archery class, even though I was terrible at it, and it wasn't the same without Chiron teaching. In arts and crafts, I started a marble bust of Poseidon, but it started looking like Sylvester Stallone, so I ditched it. I scaled the climbing wall in full lava and earthquake mode. And in the evenings, I did border patrol. Even though Tantalus had insisted we forget trying to protect the camp, some of the campers had quietly kept it up, working out a schedule during our free times. I sat at the top of Half-Blood Hill and watched the dryads come and go, singing to the dying pine tree. Satyrs brought their reed pipes and played nature magic songs, and for a while, the pine needles seemed to get fuller. The flowers on the hill smelled a little sweeter, and the grass looked greener.
But as soon as the music stopped, the sickness crept back into the air. The whole hill seemed to be infected, dying from the poison that had sunk into the tree's roots. The longer I sat there, the angrier I got. Luke had done this. I remembered his